To begin our conversation, we'd like you to introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, and how you got into Argus Camera.
Well, my name is Arthur Parker, Jr., because that has the relevance. I am a longtime resident of Ann Arbor, often referred to as a townie. I was raised and schooled in Ann Arbor. My father taught at the University of Michigan, but he also was responsible for patents on Argus Camera, the C3, which is a very famous camera. My dad had a patent on the rangefinder. At a time, we got 10 cents for every camera that was made, and they made over 2 million of them. Unfortunately, he sold the patent to them much earlier on than that, so we didn't really reap all the benefits of that. But then he left the university and went into private business and ultimately was one of the chief engineers at Argus Cameras. And I was just a youngster, had just gotten married in 1950, and I needed a job, and I was able, through my father's influence, to get a job at Argus in the industrial engineering department. And that led on to 18 years of service there before things went south at Argus, unfortunately, and I left to go to Thetford, maker of porta potties, and ultimately to Wolverine Sports, where I worked for the athletic director at the University of Michigan for the rest of my career.
So what year did you leave Argus?
1969.
So that was before their final move down to...
Yes. We were still all on 4th Avenue. The building one, which is on the east side of 4th Street, had by that time been purchased by the University of Michigan. And we were left with the building on the west side, which was the newer of the building that was constructed during part of the Second World War. And we also, at that time, also owned the brewery building, which was to the south of it. That was formerly Ann Arbor Brewery. And Argus owned that as well. In fact, our customer service department was in that, which is where the Dirksons, who you interview, worked. Dershams, rather, I should say. Art and Ellen worked there.
Now, describe a typical day. Describe your job duties and what a day was like at Argus.
When I was in the industrial engineering department, part of what we did was time studies. That was to check on the workstations to make sure that the jobs were timed. And in those days, they had an incentive program. So the person, the more they produced, the more they could make in addition to their base pay. So time studies were a part of that function. From that, I moved on into the personnel department and ran the suggestion program, which was a very successful program. That's where employees made suggestions. If they were worthwhile and saved money, the employee was rewarded for that.
The Dershams mentioned that.
Yes,
that was quite generous.
Yeah, and then that morphed on into the personnel work, because that was an offshoot of the personnel department, and I then switched over into the personnel department, and ultimately, over time, I became the personnel manager there.
So were you personnel manager when you had to start downsizing?
Our total count at one time was 1,354 employees. And I know that because I was the one that had to make the employee count each month. And when I left, there was 180 people. So I, unfortunately, I was the one who usually held the door open for all those that left. And that was not a happy time, because it was hands down the best place in Ann Arbor.
Now tell us why it is the best place to work
in
Ann Arbor.
Well, because of the way they treated their employees. We had our health insurance was superior to any place. In fact, they used to call it the baby factory, because we paid great maternity benefits. Also, I can remember that when it came time for the community chess, which it was called at that time, you know, the annual fundraiser for the charities in Ann Arbor, Argus and their employees gave more money than all the rest of the businesses in Ann Arbor combined. That was typical of the way they did things. They had an annual Christmas party for the children, which was just a spectacular affair. Every August or September, we would survey all the employees to find out how many children there were, what ages they were, and what sex they were. And then we, a committee, would go and buy presents fitting that number. Then we would rent the Michigan Theater, and we would have a live show. And Mr. Hoag, who was very wise and had been running those theaters for years, told us, we don't want to do an hour of cartoons. Kids don't have that long an attention span. So we would have two or three cartoons, and then we would have, one year we had Soupy Sales came and did the show on stage there. And then after that, the kids marched out, and all the presents were arranged by age and sex groups, and they all got it. And they were not cheap presents. There was a lot of times in those days we were spending $15 to $25 each on the toys, and at that time that was a fair amount of money.
That's a real perk.
Yes, it was. It was a wonderful affair, and yet we had it done and had done it so many times that we could do it all in an hour and a half. So, and we do it on a Saturday morning. And excuse me, I broke the microphone here. The other thing that made it a great place to work is that we acquired the rights to Independence Lake, which is just north of Ann Arbor. And it belonged to the Godfrey family. And the Godfreys, Mr. Godfrey had been the chief pharmacist for Eberbaugh and Son, which was one of the old businesses. It's right where the federal building is now. But we leased it from them, and we had our lake and picnic area out there. We had lifeguards in the summertime, and it was free to employees.
So they could go anytime? It wasn't just like once a week or something?
No, it was open all the time. And we had rowboats and for fishing and all sorts of things out there. We had a nice pavilion that we built out there with restrooms and stuff in it. Then we had what they called teen parties, and we would turn the cafeteria over to the teens, and they would either get a live band or have a DJ come in. And we learned early on to let the kids organize it, and the kids set the rules. And I can assure you their rules were much tougher than adults would play, but that's what made it successful, because they were the ones in charge. And that was rather typical. They also, because of the nature of the business, and we used to do probably 60% of our business was in the fall of the year, because the cameras and that sort of associated stuff were Christmas type items. So vacations were almost a forced issue in some ways, because we would shut down for 2 weeks and everybody would take their vacation then, because we just could not afford to let people have time off during the fall of the year. So that if there was a restrictive sort of nature to it, people didn't seem to be bothered by it too much. But the retirement fund was clearly ahead of any others that were known. I mean, it was an excellent, excellent plan. Ann Arbor Trust were the people that ran it for us, and employees left with rather handsome sums of money.
You even had your own credit union, didn't you?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we had our own credit union, yeah. That then became, it joined the Ann Arbor Credit Union, which is now in a bank now, I guess, the follow-on of it.
Well, this sounds very progressive, you know, the employee benefits and all the social things. Who put together all these fabulous ideas? Well, management or
yes,
the staff themselves?
I think the management itself. The company really started as Arborphone, and they were up on the, just on by Summit Street at the bottom of Sunset Drive, and that was the first radio. They made Arbophone radios, and then they that was the original AC/DC circuit patent on that all radios had to have at the time, and so we were licensed to do that, and that became International Industries, and that's when they got to the building down on 4th Street, and that they made cadet radios, amongst other things, and then the president of the company was a man by the name of Charlie Verscher. He went to Germany on a vacation, and he was enamored with the cameras that he saw there, the Leicas and that sort of thing, and he was convinced that we could make that sort of thing here. And so he came back with the idea, and the first cameras came out and was called the Argus A. And that morphed in, that's when my father got involved, because that morphed into one where they wanted a range finder or a lens finder on it, and that became known as the AF, which was my dad's initials. And then the C3, which was the bellwether camera, the flying brick, we used to call it because it was square. And it came out as the C2 and was modestly successful. But when my dad developed a rangefinder, and mind you, he was still at the university when this happened, that made the camera sell like it sold, and you see them even now.
Now, did they approach your dad, or did he come to them with the idea?
Well, he had done consulting work for them on a variety of things. And that's ultimately why he went to work for them, although in the interim he had worked for Westinghouse Naval Ordnance during the war and commuted to Detroit during that time. But after the war, then he went to work for Argus and stayed there. And he passed away while he was working there.
So you think the management fostered the...
Yes, I do. And one of the chief architects of that was Robert Lewis. He came, was hired from out east. I think he was in Connecticut, but he came here as president of the Argus, and he was very, very forward-looking in that respect. And a lot of these ideas were his or encouraged by him. And I can remember we had a thing called the rumor board. I don't know if the others mentioned this. But if you heard a rumor, you know, because crazy rumors go around all the time, oh, there's going to be a big layoff, an employee could write that on rumor board, and we checked that thing two or three times a day. And we'd get the rumor down, we'd run down the answer and post the answer. And the promise was we would post it within a day, and usually within hours. So, and that tended to diffuse a lot of hysteria over what things might be happening and, you know, how rumors are when you are. But that was typical of the type of thing that they did. That I think always felt was very enlightening, enlightened, I should say. I'm trying to think of some of the other things that we
now. Getting back to the social activities, mm-hmm. Who came up with the dances and all the bowling and golf leagues and that? They're just amazing pictures in the eye.
Well, except that was fairly common amongst employers. King Sealy, well, of course, they were the big gorilla on the block. They were the number one employer, along with Hoover Ball and Bearing. But they all had bowling teams. They all had basketball. There was an industrial basketball league. In fact, someplace I was going to try to get it to you folks if I can find it. I had an old basketball uniform, the jersey and the pants and the whole nine yards. I know it's there. I'll have to find it, but I'm pretty sure I have that down there. But that was, and they had softball. Of course, softball at that time was not – as heavily a women's sport as it is now. There was a lot of leagues in Ann Arbor, and Argus had a team in the league. But that was, they were just about anything that golf, anything that somebody wanted to get sponsored. They were in for that.
Now I was really impressed with how women were treated in that era as a working person. You know, a lot of women didn't work out of the home at that time, but from the scanning we did of the Argus Eye,
there was the assembly work was pretty much dominated by female employees because, you know, it was always thought that their dexterity was better, although I don't think anybody had researched that. I think that just is something that happened. But we had had Grace Radford at one time was the personnel director there. So, and that was long before that sort of thing was popular having. So there was a lot of female in executive jobs at Argus in purchasing, a variety of things. I can think of, I remember when you probably have heard of Red Berenson, Michigan hockey coach. Well, he was a kid coming to school here at Michigan to play hockey and had just gotten married, had this young wife, and she came down and applied for a job, and I hired her to work in the purchasing department, and she became one of the chief buyers in the purchasing department before he left school to go on to his career in professional hockey. But they didn't have any qualms about promoting somebody. I can remember good friend named Margaret Hardy, and she was one of the chief buyers there. So they didn't seem to have a problem with that. It was more based on your talent.
That's pretty progressive for the 1950s.
It was at the time, as you look back on it, and part of that made you a bit sheltered when you were growing up in Ann Arbor. You didn't realize that this wasn't going on every place else. And we just simply considered just a matter of fact the way things went.
Do you stay in touch with many of the former Argus employees?
Not as much as I'd like to. And of course, you know, we're getting a lot of empty saddles in the old corral these days. You know, I mean, you grab the obituary section of that thing they call .com. You know, our paper is gone. Which reminds me, I forgot to mention the Argus Eyes.
We love those.
Argus Eyes, that was my job, was overseeing the publication, the Argus Eyes, and along with a gal named Tess Kanja. And Tess went on to become the head of AARP. Now, her husband was a diver swimmer here in Michigan. But Tess, yeah, I think she's retired now, but I remember seeing that. Well, that's not a name you'd miss, because she and I worked together on the Argus Eyes, which is a good publication.
We were really curious about the column, Ask Andy. Who's Andy?
That was just Abby.
So who really answered the questions?
Well, there was a group of us that had to. You know, I mean, if you... You know, if you're going to offer that, you better be prepared to answer the questions. And some of them could get sticky at times, you know, but, you know, I had to answer it. And it stayed a non-union shop for, despite the fact that the UAW and other major unions were in the area, I think largely on the basis of the benefits and everything were better than a good many of the union jobs. Now, they did have an election for the tool room. The tool and die makers and the maintenance group did form the union, and I used to have to negotiate with them. And, it wasn't acrimonious at all. I mean, we all knew each other pretty well, you know, and we'd get down and get things settled without a lot of things. But I remember the guy from the UAW International used to get really mad because he said, "Now, I know what you guys are going to do. You're going to give all these benefits that these guys are negotiating on to the other employees, and they're not going to join. They're not going to join up." I said, "Well, it means they don't have to pay dues."
Did the personnel department oversee the scholarship program? One of the things we noticed about the Argus Eye is that every year there were wonderful scholarships given to the...
Well, the personnel department didn't really oversee that. There was a committee that was formed, you know, representing various people, like Mr. Lewis, of course, was involved, and executives were involved in it. But there was some employee involvement in it, too. But they were nice scholarships. And it was, again, I think, just part of the typically enlightened way they saw things at the time. And Mr. Aries was the president of the, or chairman of the board of directors, but he was also the head mogul at King Sealy. And King Sealy had UAW and had kind of an acrimonious relationship. And the Aries family was the one that the sons built. One of the sons built Lansdowne, and was a big builder in the area. And the other son had Trilex Corporation in Wayne. But Mr. Aries, he was a character of a guy, because I was just a kid at times, and I had to sometimes chauffeur him around when he was. And the reason that he had a chauffeur was he had a terrible habit of forgetting what he was doing and wanted to look something up in his briefcase while he was driving. And that ended up bending some fenders every now and then. So they said whenever he's over here, you have to see that he gets to where he's going, and then the King Sealy people will take over. But that was always kind of one of the humorous things that occurred over the years. But
were there a lot of multi-generational families at Argus where...
Yeah, you know, you always think about that sometimes weakening a company, but it wasn't that. There was a lot of people, family people who worked there, but it certainly wasn't a dominating kind of thing. It wasn't you hire somebody to the exclusion of somebody else because they were related. That simply didn't happen there. In my case, my father... my brother-in-law, my two younger brothers, all worked there at one time or another. A lot of them wouldn't work there in the summertime when school was in it, and some, of course, went on to more career-oriented things. But there was quite a bit of that. Well, the Crumps were not. There was quite a few husband and wife teams that worked there, and it never. to my knowledge, and I was in a position to know that sort of thing, I don't think it ever really resulted in any clash over things where somebody felt they were getting treated better than somebody else, because they really worked hard to see that wasn't the case.
Was that a good place to meet young people, like dating? Does it happen much?
No, I don't think that was... I think it may have been an offshoot of some of the hiring, but I don't think it really was...
A lot of marriages that happen because not, of working
together? You know, not really that many. And I was there 18 years, and I would remember a lot of them. There were some, but not that many.
Now, do you remember, through your dad, was he involved with Argus during the war?
Yes, he did some work for him during the war, although he had left the university during the process of the war and went to work for, it was actually Hudson Motor Car Company, had a naval ordnance plant out at 9 Mile and Mound Road, and then that was taken over by Westinghouse. But his specialty was threading and gearing, and they wanted his expertise on gun mounts for naval ships and that sort of stuff. So that his connection with Argus only really came towards the end of the war when things were winding down and they brought him in there. At one time, they made the T-155 optical scanner, which was would go into tanks. It was a periscope thing that went into tanks so the guys could see from the inside of it. And it was electronically enhanced, which is pretty heavy stuff for those days, you know. And then they made spotting scopes. A lot of them you still see around, the old kind of elbow spotting scope. And now I'm trying to think of some of the other devices they made, range-finding devices. And ultimately, they before things went really sour, we made some scopes for the AR-15 rifle, which is, of course, now the M16 or whatever they call it now. But at that time, it was just but they had a sighting thing up on the second floor, a sighting range up there. They didn't fire any of the guns up there, but they had them in the plant to do that sort of thing. But we made a lot of raw optics. We made, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had a hurry-up project on the Mitron copy lens, which was a lens for like a Super Xerox, so that they could take film right away and process it and see. And I remember we made those, and they was really interesting to us because the aircraft carriers that were on this camera or processor was so big that there was no way to get it down in the ship. So they literally had to cut a hole in the side of the aircraft carrier to push it in there and then weld it back up.
Now, were there security issues involved?
Oh, yeah, yes. We had a full-time guard service.
And did you have to ever vet employees if they were going to work on?
Yes, yeah. There were some things, although most of the stuff was pretty straightaway manufacturing, and there wasn't a little of that. Some of the engineering works and you had to have people vetted, but that was very seldom that we see that kind of thing. We had government inspectors, resident inspectors on hand, sometimes up to four or five. Were actually working at the plant during these periods of production on these things.
Agate seems to be on the forefront of new development, deep research. What made them go south? What happened to precipitate the decline?
The Japanese competition. We knew for a fact, we could prove for a fact, that the Japanese were putting cameras in the stores here at less money than what they were charging for them at home and actually below cost. But when we took our case to the Commerce Department, they said, well, you know, it's post-war, they're an emerging nation, you can't, you know, they just kind of blew us off. And ultimately got so that we just simply couldn't compete with their product that just kind of drove ours off the market, and that's what. We were then acquired by Sylvania, and that's when you really lost your identity because now you became a part of a big multinational corporation.
Why did they want Argus?
I think they wanted it because of the government work. And of course, some expansions in those days were just sheer fantasy on the part. Companies had more money than they knew what to do with. They would buy everything in sight. But we had a lot of talented people there, and a lot of them ultimately became absorbed in various divisions of Sylvania. We had a guy who was just a crackerjack. Computer guy. In fact, he ultimately ended up running the computer science program at St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri. And they were really interested in him, you know. Of course, Sylvania had a data processing operation that was probably as big as this library building at that time because, you know, computers were gigantic. And but ultimately, they worried of it, and we weren't making a profit, and they charged, I can remember specifically, we had to pay $60,000 a month corporate prorate, you know, for whatever services that the corporation offered us you know.
That's a lot of money.
Yes, it is. And we weren't really getting a value there, but we weren't in any position to complain. And they ultimately spun it off to a place in Chicago who were kind of corporate raiders. And that, and then they built the operation down in South Carolina, and which to we old-timers was sort of blasphemous, because they went there strictly because they could get cheaper labor, and that's offended a lot of us, you know. And once you lost that sense and that image, then things just did not go well from there on. And I know after I left and they moved out on South State Street, they had some really acrimonious labor relations problems there, which was sad. It was really, really sad to see that happen to it. It made you feel bad when you remember how great it was at one time. But time
where did
changed.
You go after Argus?
I went to Thetford Corporation, people that make porta potties. But then with my marvelous timing, I landed there right around the oil crisis in 73. And I thought, no, this is not the place to be. People aren't buying a lot of motorhomes these days. And that was their biggest business. And so I had worked for Don Cannon, the athletic director at Michigan, in the press box. And he said, why don't you come to work for me? And so I did, and he owned Wolverine Sports, School Tech Incorporated, and Olympia Sports was all combined things, but their primary customers were school systems, selling athletic supplies and stuff by mail order. And while Don was athletic director, that had to be in trust. So several of us managed the function for him while he was, believe me, he knew what was going on. he was a hands-on guy. But everybody said, oh, and he said, must be tough to work for him. And I said, no, you know, when you're raised in Ann Arbor around coaches, they all holler. You know, nobody, you don't pay any attention to that. You can always run faster or jump higher or one thing or another. And so it never bothered me. And Don was good to me, and I was there 20 years. And then I decided one day it was time to resign and retire. And that's not the end of the story, and I'd like to think there's more to do, because as I told her, people ask me if I've lived here all my life, and I tell them, not yet. You know, I'm.
Now, did you get tickets to the games out of any of this?
Well, I've had season tickets in for probably 40 years, and I have never sat in the seats. My family has, but I've worked in the press box for 57 years, so I've.
You got a better view anyway.
Yeah.
What do you think of the new press box?
It was. Facility-wise, it was like moving from the Days Inn to the Crown Plaza, but from a press-functioning point of view, it's lousy. They didn't center things. They moved the statisticians away from us, and when, you know, we needed them right there, because you're trying to, like, you know, for instance, with Denard, you're trying to keep track of how many yards he's gotten and how many carries, and because the phone is ringing constantly from New York and other places, and that's what we have to answer. And sometimes it gets humorous, because they'll call and say, who scored that touchdown? And say, this is ABC, right? And I say, yeah, what, you guys are carrying the game, and you got to call me and ask me what's on your own network. But they're there were a strange lot of people sometimes, media and those guys.
Sounds like you enjoyed it, though.
Oh, yeah, it's been fun. I've met a lot of luminaries over the years out there. And as a matter of fact, Saturday I got to meet the little guy with the T-shirt.
Oh, from Oklahoma?
From Oklahoma, yeah. He was a delightful child, and I can see he's going to be a nice kid, because his parents were just really, really nice people. Really nice people, because he told me, he says, you know, I can run faster than Denard. I said, well, we'll be looking to hire you here, son. But it turns out his connection is they have some family in Clarkston. And that's where I think the T-shirt got down there in the first place. But that was one of the fun things that's happened over the years. And I could tell you, that's not an Argus thing, but I could tell you a lot of stories about that.
Did you get to meet Bo?
Oh, yeah. On Fridays before home games, Don Cannon would have a press party out at his office. Now, I've got to tell you, his office was 1,200 square feet. So, and had a bar and everything in it. So Ron Kramer, a name you've probably heard of, and Jim Brandstetter, who does that, they would be the bartenders. And then all the dignitaries like Keith Jackson and all of the guys who were covering the games would come out there. And Bo would always come out and make an appearance.